Talk given Sunday, 15th January, 1973.
We have dealt so far with four of the most important of the gods, namely Varuna, who is the embodiment of transcendent virtue. He is the moral governor of the world. We have dealt with Indra, who is called the personal lord of heaven. Indra is the wielder of the thunderbolt. He is a correspondent, in certain respects, to Jehovah of the Jews, to Zeus, the wielder of the thunderbolt of the Greeks. He is also the one who slays the demon that withholds the waters of eternal life from flooding our being. And that is how he attains his lordship. He represents perfected egohood, completely free, devoid of all egoism. And therefore, he represents the coming to fruition of true human individuality, in the real sense of the term. Not merely one who is a complete whole within himself, integrated personality, as we might be inclined to say, but one who is all that, plus being in complete and full relationship with his total environment, which would imply complete unselfness. To be such an integrated individual in full relationship with the total environment. Indra really represents all this. One has to free oneself from the tendency to be confined to the word of the Rig Veda and look deeply into the implications of what is actually declared in the hymns. In the hymns themselves, sometimes there are statements which may give us something of a wrong impression. And I think it would be right to say that that wrong impression is not due mainly to the verbal formulation in the Rig Veda, but to our own shortcomings in perception. If oneself has become freed within, and one's eyes are open, one knows, because of one's own living experience, what the profounder meanings of the Vedic hymns are. Then we have dealt with Agni, the Lord of Fire. And Agni, as the Lord of Fire, is about the first stirrings of the idea of Trinity, of the Trinity, in the whole of the Indo-European religious tradition. Agni is presented as the sun in the heavens. That is his spiritual aspect. He is represented as lightning in the firmament, his psychological, his psychomental aspect. And Agni is also represented as the fire on the hearth, on your own hearth. Agni is represented as a son to oneself, as a friend, and as the messenger of the gods, and so forth. But the important point which we must bear in mind in connection with Agni, the Lord of Fire, is just this. He represents that fire, that heat of life, which burns our whole being from beginning to end. bodily life is a process of burning. Just physiologically, we just burn away all the time, from the time we are born till the time we die. We burn away. Psychologically, we burn away. How do we burn psychologically? With the fires of greed and hate and passion and delusion? Or do we burn with the light of, with the flame of that ungrasping love, that pure understanding which enables life in its totality to emerge into fruition in each one of us as the perfect individual? And lastly, the Lord of Fire represents that fire, that spiritual fire which lights the whole cosmos, and which for us implies and essentially means the emergence of the light of illumination in our own being, of enlightenment. This is Agni. And then we have dealt with Soma. Soma is the greatest of the ritualistic gods. We considered this in some considerable detail, you remember, last time we met on the Sunday, the place of ritual in the lives of those people of olden times who knew how to celebrate a ritual. They were ceremonial magicians in the true sense of the word. Your ritualist has to be a creative genius plus a person who is utterly pure in himself. And then the effect that he has upon his congregation is a magical effect. I'm using the word magical in the metaphorical sense. It's a magical effect which he has when he conducts a ritual upon the congregation, and those in the congregation who are in harmony, in tune with that ritual, find themselves transformed into something better, for good. I mean the word good in both senses, good in the sense of goodness, and good in the sense of permanence. This is the real ritualism, but it is something which is quite unknown to us today, with perhaps very, very rare exceptions in some parts of the world. It is not altogether lost by any means, but it is extremely rare. But Soma essentially is the god of inspiration. And this is what we have to bear in mind. Consider that word in inspiration. We use it in relationship to our breathing. When we breathe in, we call that in-breath an inspiration. That inspiration contains in it that without which the body would perish. Soma, as the god of inspiration, represents that inspiration, represents that in it which, without which, our spiritual life would be non-existent altogether. Regard Soma that way, and you will find something of extraordinary value in it. We went into some of the hymns regarding Soma in some detail, so we won't spend any more time on that. Let us come today to Vishwakarman. Now the name Vishwakarman means literally all making or all creating. Vishwa is all, karma is doing or making. But if you take its root meaning from Kri, it means to create, all creating. Now, this is a hymn which is rather different. I think it would be better to put it this way. This hymn shows a conception of a God who is rather different from the other gods. I'll just read it out to you. Only a few of the verses. Mighty in mind and power is Vishwakarman, maker, disposer, and most lofty presence. Their offerings, joy in rich juice, where they speak of one, only one, beyond the seven rishis. Father who made us, he who, as disposer, knoweth all races and all things existing, even he alone, the deity's name-giver, him other beings seek for information. That which is earlier than this earth and heaven, before the asuras and the gods had being, what was the germ primeval which the waters received, where all the gods were seen together? The waters, they received the germ primeval wherein the gods were gathered all together. It rested upon the unborn's navel, that one wherein abide all things existing. Ye will not find him who produced these creatures. Another thing hath arisen up among you, enwrapped in misty cloud, with lips that stammer. Hymn chanters wander and are discontented. Now, obviously, that is not an easy hymn to penetrate into. The first two verses are fairly, first three verses are fairly straightforward. We can quite understand mighty in mind and power, maker, disposer, most lofty presence. And then the next couplet, their offerings joy in rich juice, where they speak of one, only one, beyond the seven rishis. Their offerings refers to the offerings made at the sacrificial ritual, which was the Soma ritual, which was the one and only great Rig Vedic ritual of the old days. Later on, about 1,000 years after this great ritual started, other rituals sprang up associated with worldly matters, such as coronations, for instance, with household duties and all kinds of things like that. Father who made us, we can understand that. He who as disposer knoweth all races and all things existing, that we can understand. Even he alone, the deity's name-giver, him other beings seek for information. One can see what the poets of the Rig Veda were trying to convey. They were trying to convey the idea of a unitary supreme God. Now, the whole of the Rig Veda never produced any such conception. One single supreme being as such. There were tendencies towards a strict monotheism, but they didn't come to anything. The tendencies to strict monotheism came to fulfillment in the other branch of the Indo-European peoples, which went westward into Iran. Zarathustra, the prophet of Iran, presents the teaching in terms of Ahura Mazda, Lord of Life and Wisdom, who is a purely spiritual and ethical being, and is to be seen only with inward vision and in no other way. That is Zarathustra's presentation. Now, the Rig Vedic Indians never did that. They produced this hymn, they produced a few other hymns, but it never culminated in a pure monotheism. There were also, and these were the stronger tendencies of the Rig Veda, tendencies towards monism. And it was monism which finally found its richest fulfillment in terms of the philosophy, the teachings, I should say. I dislike the word philosophy in connection with the Upanishads. The Upanishads are not a philosophy. I think it's a great mistake to talk about the philosophy of the Upanishads. I won't go into reasons expanding that. We can do that some other time. These monistic tendencies are, of course, very strongly indicated in the Rig Veda. Now comes the verse which is, that which is earlier than this earth and heaven. Now we are trying to go back to origins, and the understanding of origins which defy time, to go back to the timeless. Because that which is before heaven and earth has no time in it. Time comes into being only where there is regular movement. Movement of translation through space. Because if you once have distance and velocity, you can have time. Distance is simply velocity multiplied by time. All right, therefore time is distance divided by velocity. We cannot free our minds functioning down here from that basic conditioning. Time cannot be conceived of, cannot be experienced in any other terms as such. So we have chronological time fixed for us that way. But here, that which is earlier than this earth and heaven, before the Asuras and the gods, the Devas, had being. Asuras is a term which has its complementary term, Suras, and they represent the constructive and the disruptive forces of the universe. All universal process is in terms of an interaction between constructive and disruptive energies, forces at play. That's how the becoming process of the universe can go on. It can't otherwise. So now the poet is making this is actually groping towards expressing his personal realization of that which is origin, that which is transcendent, the wholly other than, if you like, whatsoever man's mind can conceive or express. Before the Asuras and the gods had being, what was the germ primeval which the waters received, where all the gods were seen together? You find this mention of waters in all the religious traditions of the world. You find fire, earth, and so on also mentioned. The waters, let me put it generally this way. Water, earth, bread represents the negative feminine aspect, female aspect of things. Fire, air, and wine represent the male aspect. Now here is an interesting thing. It is hidden in the very, very old teachings. Most people don't know about it. Some do. The male aspect does nothing but just is present. By its very presence, it fecundates the negative, the female aspect. It is the so-called negative aspect which is responsible for all the positive activity and process of the universe. This female aspect contains the complementary duals, and through the fecundative influence of the male aspect, these complementary duals start up into activity and produce the whole becoming process. This teaching is common to both great traditions, the tradition of the Indo-European peoples as well as of the Semitic peoples. These are things which are extremely difficult to grasp with the brain, with the mind. Don't try to make a logical system out of it. We would only produce a heap of nonsense. Let the words somehow stimulate the mind. If they don't, well, leave it alone. Don't worry about it. But if the words can somehow stimulate the mind in the right way, then you will sense with a deeper faculty of the mind what it all means and implies. But never can it be put into a foolproof logical system. Do remember that. Now, whilst we are talking about this, let me once again mention that all the gods that are talked of in all the religious systems of the world, in their inner reality, are not beings outside us somewhere, flying about in aerial spaces or enjoying wonderful feasts on Mount Olympus or on Mount Kailas if you're in India and so forth, you see. Nothing of the sort. The gods are our creation, including the supreme god of any monotheistic system. Because that which we worship is our conception, which we present as God. And it is only because of our differing conceptions about God that human beings can quarrel and argue and point out that, oh no, your God is not the supreme God. He is not such a great God as my God. People little realize that they are indulging in the supreme expression of self-conceit and egoism and cruelty within their own nature when they argue like that. God cannot be conceived of. The word represents a reality, the absolute reality. And the word gods, archangels, angels, demons, they all represent, they are our pictures representing the play, the real activity of energies which are reality. Man, in the deeper states of consciousness, sensing this, finds it impossible to talk about it, excepting in these somewhat crude anthropomorphized terms. So don't get misled when you read these things. They are all within ourselves. The gods are apotheosized representations of one's own touching of these transcendent energies and the way they manifest themselves. These energies are archetypal energies which determine not the external history of the human race, but the story of the growth of consciousness, the flowering out of consciousness of human beings. That is what they represent. So now, the waters, it's the feminine aspect, they received the germ primeval wherein the gods were gathered all together. It's perfectly obvious, therefore, that they did sense very clearly that all the so-called separate gods only represented different aspects of one fundamental reality. It, that is the germ, rested set upon the unborn's navel. You know, one has just to sort of let the mind be quiet. The unborn's navel, the importance of the navel, the idea of the navel, that one wherein abide all things existing. I think in Hindu mythology we have this somewhat expressed in a great variety of ways. The idea of the navel and the emergence out of the navel. You see, look at the importance of the navel for us as human beings. Every single one of us is connected through the navel of the mother and her mother and so forth, right up to our biological origins. There is this cord of connection, the umbilical cord. When we are born, the umbilical cord is cut. And we are inclined to think of starting off on a separate life from the mother. Supposing I put it this way, when the umbilical cord is cut, we are not separated from our mother, but we are on our own now in a new relationship with the mother. If that umbilical cord isn't cut, of course, the child will die. The great purpose of this is that we shall grow into individuals ourselves by being on our own. And the possibility, what was just potentially existent in the embryo, now has the opportunity on its own, in this new environment, with this new relationship to the mother to start with, to come to fruition as the, finally, as the adult, mature human being. Of course, the psychological maturity is never realized by the vast millions. Only a few ever realize this psychological maturity. See, the individual psyche, the personal psyche of each person has no chance if it doesn't learn to stand on its own feet. It has to be on its own and grow to awareness of a new kind of relationship with its environment. Relationship quite different from the relationship which the embryo has within the womb. So, it rested set upon the unborn's navel. Now this verse, extremely significant. You will not find him who produced these creatures. Another thing hath arisen up among you. What is this other thing that has arisen up among you, which the Holy One who wrote that hymn meant? When we experience anything in the world, we do not experience the thing in itself. We do not know it, we do not sense it, touch it directly, as such, in itself. Whatsoever one sees or hears or touches or smells or tastes, etc., whatsoever one thinks and feels and so forth, produces a picture inside one's own mind. It is that picture of which I am aware. We all know this as a purely physiological fact. When I look in that direction, I see a rows and rows of books on a bookshelf. And I say, in the ordinary way, I see books on a bookshelf. But I'm not seeing those books and that bookshelf in their actuality. I am seeing the picture which is thrown upon the brain cells at the back of my head. And I am interpreting the effect which is produced on those brain cells. I'm interpreting that effect limited by my conditioning, and especially the way I've learned to name things from my childhood onwards. It is, as said in India, it is a maya. It is an illusory vision. The books are there, the bookshelf is there, I am here, there is a looking, yes, of course, all that is so. But the actual conscious awareness, the interpretation of what I am seeing, has its illusory element. This, I believe, is the other thing that has arisen up amongst you. Have you ever tried to visit the gods at home, in their home? Try and meet the gods and see what happens. But don't try until you're well enough, you're strong enough, and stable enough to stand the impact. It is overwhelming. Because, you see, the gods are a universal psychical energy which manifests through all mankind. So when we contact that which is universal and common to all mankind at a transcendent level, or at a very deep or a very powerful level, we get overwhelmed. I mean, how many times the great geniuses of the world, or even less than the great geniuses, have recorded the fact that when this particular illumination or idea or something or solution to the problem came, they were just completely bowled over. I fell backwards type of expression, one gets. This is what happens, you see. So one needs to be very much all there to take the impact of the gods. Now, so much for Vishvakarman, the all-creating. Just one other word in connection with him. It's a very interesting fact that practically the first descriptive word which is applied to God, whether in the monotheisms or the non-monotheistic religions, the first word applied to whatever is recognized as supreme is creator or creative power. You see why? Our first awareness of anything in our life, whether it be right down in the physical world or in terms of philosophy or art or in the transcendent realm, our first innermost unconscious awareness, that's a paradoxical phrase to use, but I'll use it, unconscious awareness is in terms of the play of energy, of creative energy. God is creator. Or there is some, if you use the scientific type of language, you say primordial energy or whatever it is. But it creates. Even science has come to the point where when it raises up its cosmologies, modern cosmologies, talks in terms like this, that, oh, every half hour or whatever it is, within every cubic mile of space or a cubic million miles of space or whatever it is, an electron is created or a hydrogen atom is created. They say just created, it just comes. The good old idea of creation out of nothing, as we call it. And we, unaware, unable to touch those profounder dimensions of consciousness, which are totally beyond us at present, use the word creation in relation to creating out of nothing, out of no thing. We can't avoid it. So one of the great lessons we have to learn in connection with the understanding of the gods or God as creator and creative energy is that we can know only to a very small extent. If we wake up to the fact that we don't know, and still more deeply, if we wake up to the fact that we cannot know beyond a certain point, we cannot know it. And when we wake up to that fact and can remain in equanimity, in balance, in poise, then indeed that mind has gone a long way towards fruition. And it is a pure mind. Such a mind, a person with that sort of mind, has no conflict of pride, conceit on the one hand, and humility or self-derogation on the other hand. No such conflict. One just knows, I don't know. It's a simple fact. And one remains poised, and therefore the mind is open and sensitive, and therefore it can learn and know in the real sense more and more. This is one of the great things one can learn from the study of the scriptures of the world, any of the scriptures of the world. We will now go on to Hiranyagarbha. Hiranyagarbha literally means the golden womb. Hiranya is gold, golden, and Garbha is womb. Sometimes they refer to Hiranyagarbha as an egg, And if you read the mythologies of the world, you will find any number of mythologies where the mysterious egg is split in two and out comes the great god of the universe who creates everything else and all the rest of it and so forth. This idea of the egg or the golden womb. But note, there is a significance in using the term golden with respect to the womb here. Let me read the poem for you. In the beginning rose Hiranyagarbha, born only Lord of all created beings. He fixed and holdeth up this earth and heaven. Giver of vital breath, of power and vigor, he whose commandments all the gods acknowledge, whose shade is death, whose luster makes immortal, who by his grandeur hath become the sole ruler of all the moving world that breathes and slumbers, he who is lord of men and lord of cattle. By him the heavens are strong and earth is steadfast. By him light's realm and sky vault are supported. By him the regions in mid-air were measured. He in his might surveyed the floods containing productive force and generating worship. The floods containing productive force. You remember what I said a little while ago about the waters and the feminine aspect of things. He is the God of gods and none beside him. Now each of these verses ends up, it has four lines. I've read only three lines out of each verse. The fourth line in every case is, what God shall we adore with our oblation? Now this word Hiranyagarbha is extremely interesting. I've made a few notes out of one of the very little known Upanishads. You won't find it in the usual volumes of the so-called principal Upanishads, although Radhakrishnan does include it in his volume of the 18 principal Upanishads. Usually they are 12 or 13. Now this is called the Paingala Upanishad. Paingala was the disciple. He was the son of Pingala. Therefore he is called Paingala. That's how they named, you see, people in those days. And he was the disciple of perhaps the greatest of all the Upanishadic teachers, no less than Yajnavalkya himself, you see. And in answer to his inquiry, Yajnavalkya expounds as follows. He starts off with a statement about Brahman being the absolute all, the one and only, the secondless, etc., that are completely transcendent. And then he says that in Brahman is contained Mula Prakruti. Mula Prakruti is the root of Prakruti. Mula is root. Prakruti means primordial nature. You may regard it this way, that in Brahman is contained the root principle of all differentiation and manifestation. Now, when this Mula Prakruti, this root principle of differentiation and manifestation, is reflected in Brahman, who descriptively is spoken of as absolute consciousness, pure consciousness, chit, absolute chit. Very frequently they use the triple definition, description, sat, chit, ananda, being, consciousness, bliss. See, in that form. Now, when this root principle is reflected in Brahman, there arises what is called the witness self. This is the witness self, the one that merely looks on. Now the next stage follows as thus. When Mula Prakruti undergoes change, it becomes the unmanifested due to the preponderance of sattva. Sattva is the word which means that which is the utterly pure, the perfect. It is rhythm. It is, perhaps if you like, harmony. It is also used to represent truth, sattva. But in the absolute sense. And being in the absolute sense, therefore, it is associated with the unmanifested. So, Mula Prakruti, due to the preponderance of this guna quality called sattva, becomes the unmanifested and has the power of veiling Brahman. Veiling, putting a veil over Brahman. Now the next stage is as follows. What is reflected in this unmanifested is the Ishvara consciousness. Ishvara is the nearest Brahmanical equivalent to the Christian idea of a personal God. It is one of the nearest equivalents. The God, the personal being, Ishvara, also related to the Judaic idea of God as the strong one, Ishvara, of his self-subsistent by virtue of his own inward strength. See, that's the idea, Ishvara. So, what is reflected in the unmanifest is the Ishvara consciousness. What you must note very carefully is the introduction of the word consciousness. It is called in the original Sanskrit the Ishvara Chaitanya. Chaitanya, consciousness. See, it is this word which saves the wary one from falling into the trap of thinking of Ishvara as a separate entity, a being. It is your own inner consciousness. Ishvara has Maya, creative power, under control. Ishvara is all-knowing, the first cause of creation in the sense of starting off the world process and also of the sustenance and the dissolution of the world. All is ascribed to this Ishvara consciousness. Now, from the power of veiling which Ishvara has comes the power of projection, which is just simply called Mahat. M-A-H-A-T, Mahat. And this power of projection comes due to the preponderance of Rajas, the quality of motion, of movement, the movement of translation, moving across. You can see at once that the whole idea of our categories of, as Kant propounded, space and time and so forth, come into being with that. What is reflected in it is the Hiranyagarbha consciousness, the golden womb consciousness is reflected in this. It conceives Mahat Tattva. Now, Tattva here is used in the sense of essential being, essence of being, or if we like to be a little bit careless, we'll call it stuff. And Mahat Tattva, if you were to translate it as great mind or supreme mind or transcendent mind stuff, you see, will give you the idea of it. It conceives Mahat Tattva as its own and has as its form, and has its form manifested both distinctly and indistinctly. Now, you see the reason for the indistinctly. When one enters into the deep states of consciousness, one very soon goes beyond all that with which we are familiar. This is known to all the contemplative mystics of the world, whatever their faith. First, one of the first and the biggest step, perhaps, really, takes place when there is the cessation of discursive thought, which implies, therefore, that all the sense images which make up the substance of our mind have been brought to a state of peace and quietness. They no longer impinge upon your consciousness. We do that every day in our lives when we fall into deep slumber. Not the dream sleep, but the dreamless sleep. It happens. But we can never bring back from our dreamless sleep state the extraordinary things that happen in the dreamless sleep state, in the inner deeps of mind and of consciousness. We can't do it. But when one goes through these religious disciplines, one is awake. But awake not with the awakeness that we know here and now in the outer world. It's a different kind of awakeness. It is the awakeness in complete stillness, in complete restfulness. You see? And so, when one gets to this state where you get to the Hiranyagarbha consciousness, which is the golden womb out of which emerges all that we see in terms of differentiation, this is how those old sages presented it. So at first, there is the aspect of the unconscious associated with it. One cannot give a clear description of what happens. This is the indistinct part. But the distinctness is when you are actually in that state itself. Then it is very distinct. But come back to ordinary consciousness, and everything becomes blurred. Because in the return of consciousness from that state to our ordinary state here, we lose a dimension or two or more of being and consciousness in the process. That is why the indistinctness. Now, from the power of projection in Hiranyagarbha comes the power of making gross bodies, they say, known as Ahankara. Ahankara means the eye-maker, that which sets up the eye-consciousness, I am I. The separate eye-consciousness, set known as Ahankara. Now it is because of the activity of Ahankara that we are aware of our world in terms of separate particulars, persons, objects, events, and so forth. Supposing we were to be able to go right beyond the limitations imposed upon us by our separate self-sense, we would be conscious of the world in its totality simultaneously. But it's the mercy of God that we are not conscious in the normal way, in that way. Because our brains simply would be shattered by the impact of multitudinous impressions, all in a oneness, in a singleness. We'd be driven crazy. Here lies the hint regarding bewaring of meditation practices which take you into very deep states of consciousness. Time and again, this happens. One has to be very careful how one plays with the deeper energies of the mind. Or shall I put it this way, with the energies of the depths of the mind. Now, the Upanishad goes on to say that what is reflected in Ahankara is what is called the Virat consciousness, from which emerge all the differentiations, which in the old days, you know, they just called fire, earth, air, water, ether. I think the important point we should bear in mind in connection with all this is that the great poet seers, the holy ones who compose the hymns of the Rig Veda, tried to express in language that which they realized in the deep states of consciousness. And this realization is possible only when there is the right preparation for entering these deep states, which means complete purity, absolute purity as the basis. And then the training of body and psyche in such a way as not to obtrude itself and all its conditioning and all its limitations upon the free movement of consciousness into its own inner being and reality. I have said again and again, if you recall, that the whole story of spiritual development is the story of the transformation of one's own consciousness. And the living of the holy life is the living of a life which culminates in this supreme spiritual freedom within the depths of consciousness. And only there does freedom have a true meaning. Our meaning of freedom is very much nearer license than the reality of freedom. And when the holy life is lived, and these things are realized through our individual being, then our individual being has lived its life not vainly, but fulfilled the purpose of its existence in the world. And in this fulfilling, the transcendent has emerged into self-awareness through what we commonly call man.